This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Michael Brissenden is a journalist and novelist. He has worked for the ABC for more than 30 years. A two-time Walkley Award winner, Michael is now a reporter on ABC's Four Corners. His debut novel, The List, was published in 2018, and Dead Letters is his second novel, published by Hachette this year. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks, Kate. It's lovely to be here.
Now, you probably get this all the time, but if someone had told 12-year-old me, who religiously watched the ABC with my parents every night, watching, you know, Michael Brissenden reporting from Washington or Brussels or wherever you were, that one day I myself would write a book and that I would be interviewing you about the novels that you'd written, I obviously would not have believed them at all. So it's quite a delight. And when I said to my mum, I'm interviewing Michael Brissenden, and she was like off the news. So yeah, like off the news. So it's a delight to speak to you. Congratulations on the new book.
Great. Thank you so much.
Now, we're going to go right back, as we always do, because we are the First Time Podcast. And obviously, professionally, you were a journo long before you were publishing any fiction. But I want to know if there was maybe some secret fiction in primary school, the newsletter. You know, did you write a letter to the editor that got published somewhere? What was your relationship with writing when you were young?
It's an interesting question. And when I was very young, I loved stories and fiction. I've always loved story, right? And I think as I sort of got older into my teens, I got very interested in history, and I got very interested in, not politics in a sort of Australian party political sense, but just in the nature of politics. And so I thought, you know, when I got to about 14, I wrote this thing for the school. The school paper asked me to go and interview the local member. And I remember I went and did it, and I did the interview, and I came back and I wrote the story and I put it in the paper, and it was like the easiest thing I had ever done in my life. It was the only thing I'd ever done that seemed to come naturally to me, you know, like I didn't have to really even try. And I thought, wow, that was incredible. What a, you know, like that had never happened to me as a 14-year-old. And at that moment I thought, well, you know, maybe that's what I should do. And it took a long time to sort of get to that point because, you know, I went off in various different directions. But I got to my mid-20s and I had this sort of mid-20s crisis, and I thought, well, you know, what am I good at? And I thought, well, that's the only thing I've ever done that seemed to have come naturally that I was, you know, and I was really passionate about it. And so that's what I did.
I love that. Do you still have it in the family scrapbook, that first interview?
Probably. My mother's probably...
Because there were a lot of books in your house too. Your father was a writer and an academic, so you were surrounded by books. What were you reading when you were young?
Look, lots of stuff. I think I started off. My father used to read me Greek myths when I was a young.
Excellent grounding.
You know, which is great because it's got all of that in it. You know, the drama, the politics, the sort of, you know, all that sort of stuff. And then when I was a teenager, I was really interested in science fiction. I read a lot of science fiction. I read a lot of fiction, just general fiction as well, because my father was really, you know, like he, although his sort of specialty was, I mean, he was a poet and he was a specialist in 18th century literature and modern American poetry and stuff. But actually what he really liked reading was were thrillers and crime novels and those sorts of things. So they were always all around the house. And so I read a lot of that. Those were the sorts of things I was reading. But I then became sort of really interested in history, I think, like I said, and I read a lot of nonfiction and a lot of history as well as I got older.
You also, you're also a musician. You've played in bands and you play the double bass. I'm always interested in people who are able to be artistic in more areas than one. How is playing music like writing? What skills can you transfer from one to the other, if any?
Look, I think it's there are some interesting parallels. I think it's a singularly focused sort of thing. So even when you're playing in a band, you are you can sort of lose yourself in the moment. And I find that a lot when you're writing, you can really, you get somewhere and you're not quite sure how you got to that point. Playing music, playing jazz in particular, is really like that. It requires practice. It requires patience and dedication. And the more you do it, the better you get, all of which apply to writing. But it's, I think it uses a creative part of your brain. That's why I love writing fiction too, is that part of your brain that you're not quite sure where it's going to go, how it's going to end up, but it's sort of sometimes also quite confined by the structure that you're working in. So there are many similarities, I think.
I like that you mentioned there about discipline, because I was thinking as I was reading some interviews with you that, you know, they talk about this idea of mastery in 10,000 hours, and that you, with your enormous career in journalism, you know, you have been doing the collection and the publication of stories for a really long time. You have absolutely got those 10,000 hours. What do you think are the key things that you learned about good story writing and telling a good story through your journalism career?
Yeah, look, a lot, I think, actually. Essentially, they're the same sort of thing. I mean, we're storytellers, right? The difference in writing fiction is you're telling your own story rather, in a sense, you're making it up. But the same things apply, particularly with sort of long-form journalism. You know, you have to have structure. You have to bring people along. You have to excite people to start with, to get them engaged, to want them to stay with the narrative. You have to have something somewhere along the way that is unexpected or surprising or revealing. And you have to sort of have a conclusion that leaves people not necessarily having everything wrapped up nicely, but leaves people going away from it, going, oh, I never thought of that, and that'll stay with me for some time. And, you know, those are sorts of, I think in terms of narrative structure, I've brought a lot of that to me in my fiction writing, because those same things sort of apply when you're reading fiction. You want those sorts of moments there, don't you, where you know, the story turns unexpectedly. There's some surprise there. There's a moment where you think, oh, I didn't think that was going to happen. And when you get to the end of a great book, you go, oh, you know, it sits with you, you know, it really does. And that's,
Do you collect, I'm interested if you collect your material in the same way, like whether you're a kind of notes in your phone and then onto some kind of a spreadsheet, or you a whiteboard plotter, like what's the way that you begin that process of getting a story from inside your head or from a source onto the page?
Yeah, that's very similar too. In fact, I really approach it in the same way as I approach doing long-form journalism. Like, I'm constantly taking notes about ideas, conversations, snippets of things that I think might be interesting, characters, names, all those sorts of things. I sort of generally have a sort of broad idea about, you know, where the story, what sort of story it is and where it's going. But, you know, that develops over time, and all that research gets put into a, you know, book number such and such file in the laptop. And then I do whiteboard, actually. I whiteboard a lot. I find a whiteboard a really useful tool. I have a sort of word count down one side. I've got a structure in the middle. I've got sort of ideas on the other side. And I also stick stuff up everywhere. So, yes, it's a sort of an organic process, I suppose. But
sticking stuff up, can you see the mess that is behind me? Is I decided to do the walls in here as pinboards so that I could stick all the things up everywhere.
That's a great idea.
I want to talk about rejection. I listened to your great interview with Tim Ayliffe for Sydney Crime Writing Festival, and we'll link to this so people can watch it. And you revealed to him that you had a crack at fiction at one point, and you put out this 90K manuscript, and it was roundly rejected. And I think that our listeners would be really interested to know, because I think most people would assume that someone with a profile such as yours wouldn't be too troubled getting their foot in the door of the publishing world. So what happened? Why were you rejected?
Oh, it wasn't very good, I think it's probably. look, it had its moments, you know. It was my first real attempt at writing a sort of genre, in the genre fiction, in a big sense, like a full manuscript. And I thought it was, you know, I wasn't quite sure. I thought it was okay, but, you know. And I sent it off to various literary agents and publishers and whatever, most of whom completely ignored it. And You know, I got one reply which basically said, well, look, you know, it's not really for us. And there were, you know, there were some problems with it. But it had one great line in it, which was, you know, it was something about the traffic sucking you into Moscow or something, you know. And I thought, is that it? Like one line.
Got out of the 90,000, there was one. That's a start.
So, yeah, it went nowhere. And I didn't try again really until, probably 20, you know, nearly 20 years.
Wow. Okay. But so something did make you try again. So there's obviously a compulsion there that is, you know, one day I'm going to turn that one great line into a few more consecutive ones. And so someone will buy this book. How did you do it in the end? Because you must have been feeling a little sheepish about trying to get it out there.
Absolutely. I just think I wasn't really ready when I first did it. You know, I just wasn't. Yep. I didn't have the skills, I didn't have the history, I didn't have the, you know, some people can write really great books in their 20s. That was never going to be me, clearly. I needed to be older, I needed to have more experience, more maturity, and really approach it with much more sort of, you know, almost, not clinical is not the right word, but, you know, deliberately, I think. And with the list, you know, the ideas just sort of came to me. I thought, wow, this is really, you know, it's about sort of our, about our approach to counterterrorism and the sort of the social currents that are flowing around all of that, and the discussions that were being had at the time, and the politics and the communities and all of that. And I thought, you know, this is such a great story, but there's a way to tell this in fiction that actually could be really interesting. And so I think I was much more deliberate about how I approached it. And once I've done that, then actually I found within that the ability to become much more creative because I sort of had structure, you know, and I think that was the problem with my first attempt is I was trying to be creative without the structure. Mm. And I think I wasn't really sure, you know, I had a couple of good ideas, but I wasn't really sure in that first instance where, you know, where it was going to take me. Whereas this time I did have a much more defined narrative already in my head. And once I'd settled on that, then, yeah, it was a lot easier.
You've talked about your curiosity, which is, of course, what fuels the fire for both journalism and fiction. Can you give us some of your tips for sniffing out those excellent stories, like whether they be for journalism or for fiction, those ones that have those complex layers, that have a bit of meat in them, that you're like, yes, this is a good story to tell?
You know, I just love stories that, and I think that this is what particularly sometimes genre fiction can do, that, you know, journalism can't do sometimes is really tell a multi-layered story about some of the big issues and currents that are sort of coursing through our lives. Because, you know, often, for instance, you know, if we go back to the list and we're talking about those sorts of counterterrorism arguments, you know, there's so many layers to that story. There are so many things in there. There's how it's impacting the immigrant communities, how it's impacting the law enforcement, how it's impacting our politics. And all of those things, I think, become writing fiction gives us a way of telling those stories that, you know, even through dialogue, you can tell so much more through dialogue sometimes than being didactic, you know, and that to me is really exciting. So I really like finding these. It's almost like finding issues, but actually not being didactic about how you use that, and reflecting that in a sort of a fictional narrative to me is a really exciting way of presenting those ideas. Mm-hmm. Of course, individual personalities become involved. It becomes a personal story and a human story as well, and all of that's really important. But, you know, I think sometimes, you know, you can... I don't know, I say this often, but, you know, people say, well, you know, why would you write genre fiction? And you think, well, if you look at something like someone like Don Winslow, for instance, and his books about the border and about the drug wars and the cartel, the cocaine cartels and this whole war on drugs, and he's written these three books which are, you know, standalone sort of genre fiction, but they tell you so much about the politics of those moments, about what the sort of social issues that are coursing through our lives and how we deal with these big problems.
And they get
quite answers the question, but
no, it does. But I also think that argument, you know, they also get to a lot of readers. they get to a lot of readers. And isn't that not our purpose, to get the story, you know, and connect it to people? There's a kernel of a true story at the centre of Dead Letters. And I wondered if you might just tell us a little about a bit about that story and what started you on the journey of writing Dead Letters.
Yeah, so this, the kernel of the truth of the story is the murder of a woman called Shirley Finn, who was a brothel madam in Western Australia, in Perth, in the 1970s, and she was in a relationship with a senior politician at the time, and it's believed that money was being laundered through her business, and that she had a huge that the tax department was after her, and she was appealing to people to actually pay her tax bill. Otherwise, she was going to blow the lid in on you know, all of the things that were going on. And she was murdered. No one's ever been held account. You know, there's a cold case. No one knows who murdered her. But I thought, you know, and at the time she was in a relationship with a very senior political figure. And I thought, well, that's a really, what an interesting story, right?
So it's a gift.
It's such a great story. And what happens when, and so I thought, well, what if we, you know, transported that for me to somewhere that I know, to Sydney? It happened in the early point of some political career or political careers, and then those people go on to become very senior political people, in this case into the Prime Minister's office, many years later, and that crime returns. What are the consequences of that? And to me, that was just such an intriguing idea. That was the starting point, really, and sort of things flowed off from that.
It is an intriguing idea, the idea of historical things coming back to meet the members of the Prime Minister's office. And it's so interesting to talk to you about this week, Michael, because I think, you know, dirty kind of dealings in politics and corruption and the rest of it are never hard for readers to imagine. But we're recording this interview at the beginning of March, and there is just this palpable rage in the community right now, particularly from women, at the kinds of behaviours that politicians feel entitled to engage in. And I wondered, from your perspective, through your long career, is it getting worse? Are we pulling people up, and is that why we're seeing it more? And will there ever be a reckoning?
I don't know. I hope so. I think this is a real moment for us. And I do think that we are pulling people up, and expectations have changed. You know, I was around Parliament House in the 1980s and the 1990s in particular, you know, but that's a long time ago now. And the culture of the place was no different, hasn't changed. And, you know, it is a uniquely weird, but I really do think we are at this moment where expectations have changed enormously, where people are not going to, you know, I really hope we are, because there is, you know, there is this sense of entitlement about the way people conduct themselves there. Those sorts of old informal rules about, you know, who has the power in that place. And, you know, the fact that people feel that they are so entitled that they can go and do some extraordinary things and not be accountable for them. I don't know. I do think now this is a really big wake-up moment for us, and I really hope that there's going to be some change, because clearly it can't continue.
No, like it must. I hope so too. It's interesting. I was thinking about how, you know, writers who are writing memoir often talk about this idea of protecting the people in their lives who they're writing about, and whether they, you know, change names, or they kind of, you know, merge two people together, or they change genders, things like that, or they talk about how they have published the truth and then the ramifications of that. And I was thinking about this idea of the places you get information from and have over your long career, and the very practical and logistical ways in which you might have to protect your sources. Can you talk a little bit about how some of those stories come to you? When I was reading Dead Letters, I was like, mate, are people going to get in trouble for this? Like, is anyone recognisable in this book? Or how well has Brissenden done to make sure that this is absolute fiction? You know, how do you grapple with that?
Well, it's total fiction.
Total fiction, Michael. We understand that, but where did it come from?
But of course, you know, we bring our own experience to our writing, right? I mean, you can't divorce yourself from your own experience, and a lot of it, a lot of those sorts of things are informed by my experience and my long experience in that area. But having said that, it's a fantastical story, right? It's not. But I think some of the mechanics of the way that the politics works and how it relates and operates with the media in particular, that's just stuff that comes from my own personal experience. That is the way these sorts of relationships are. That is the sort of interaction that these people have with each other. The workings of political offices and those sorts of things are things that, I've imagined, but, I've imagined from an informed base. Yeah,
and I think that's really interesting for reading, because I think that way in which we tend, some people tend to kind of disengage with politics in Australia because, it's kind of so obtuse over there behind all those things and the press conferences and the, the kind of rhetoric we get fed. So it's interesting to know, this is how a leak works. where the power actually lies.
But, the character in this book, Barry Angel, who is the prime chief of staff and is basically manipulating the media and pushing stuff out to favoured people and, sort of railing against his lack of control and the fact that, social media has exploded all over the place and they can't really do anything about it. And all of that's real. That stuff happens. We used to have this joke about, during the Howard era about the truck backing up to a certain newspaper office every afternoon, beep, 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 with the next day's leaks. I mean, these things happen. That is how politics tries to manipulate the media and use the media for favours, and there are people who are on the drip, so to speak, and those sorts of relationships, media and political relationships as well, are things that, it's a reality, right?
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily all good.
No, and it's and one of the things that's so enjoyable about reading a book like Dead Letters is understanding that, helps again with that critical literacy, being able to look at the news and say, where did this come from, this story? Yep. Who wants me to read this story and why?
That's right.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I'm really interesting. I have to ask. I interviewed Chris Hammer a couple of years back and he told me the story about how he names his characters. And I see your character, Zephyr Wilde, and the first thing I think about is Hammer's character, Mandalay Blonde. And what I loved about what Chris said was that I think that the names he originally had in his manuscript were like placeholders. He just couldn't think of any names. And then when he got to the end of it, he was like, I'll keep them in. And how many readers have said, it's great because I know who's who in your books because there's not all these people called Jack or Tom.
Yeah.
Tell me.
Look, I'm not, my books don't contain as many sort of Dickensian names as Chris's.
Not quite.
But Zephyr, that was a character I really wanted her to stand out. I really wanted her to be someone memorable. And her name is really important. I wanted it to be an interesting sort of active name without being tough, without being hard. Mm-hmm. And this idea of a sort of a gentle breeze followed by a sort of statement to me seemed really appropriate, So Zephyr Wilde seemed to sum up her character really well, and that's really where
she's a great character. I have to ask because it's almost my duty to ask a white man how he writes women well. How do you write women well, and what is there anything that terrifies you about getting it right?
Yeah, look, I think this is particularly in this sort of genre fiction, you can really fall into a trap of sort of the old white man writing about women, and it can be pretty icky, right? I think, it's one of the things, I'm surrounded by pretty strong young women. I have two daughters in their 20s. I have a wife who I've been with for a very long time. And, I have some pretty strong female characters around me, and I'm very aware of the dangers of not, of my daughters challenging me.
Do you check stuff with them?
Well, I sort of do, yes, but not until it's, not until it's well and truly done. But I think, one of the things I am actually quite proud of is being able to write sympathetic women female characters and strong female characters. And I think in both books there are some very, very strong female characters, and they often drive the narrative. So I am very aware of that, and it's something I really, you know, do try and do. And I'm glad that, you know, the women who read these books do say to me, look, you know, yes,
that's that was good. Done well. Yeah. Oh, you'd hear about it if you didn't do it well, Michael. Yeah, we promise you. There's this note of irony in Dead Letters in the fact, and I think you've talked about this with Tim, that there's such incredible collaboration between the crime organisations. There's this, I think you called it cross-cultural, and you commented on it being a kind of fascinating, you know, issue at the heart of your book. Should we be finding hope in the fact that there's great collaboration between crime organisations, or is that not something we want to find hopeful?
Yeah, I don't think it's a very hopeful development. I mean, look, I think it's just a case of these old enmities breaking down to a degree that money and drugs are more important than historical division.
So it will never cross over to politics or foreign relations.
Look, you know, I think in the criminal world, money drives everything. And that's sort of what's happening, you know. This convergence of criminal activity is fascinating, and I think, you know, pretty confronting for people who are trying to deal with it because, I mean, you know, in Sydney we used to have the Middle East Organised Crime Squad, which was, you know, built and enabled and defined on tackling what was seen as the biggest criminal gang crime problem in Sydney at the time, which was Middle East crime gangs. Well, it's just not relevant anymore because, and it probably never was really. But you know, now it's, you know, you've got Middle Eastern criminal gangs working with Balkan gangs, working with Vikings, working with, you know, and the injection of the South American cartels and, you know, all this sort of stuff. It's extraordinary what's going on. But also, interestingly, most people you talk to say, yes, all of that's happening, but, you know, a lot of this is still being, a lot of the sort of delivery mechanisms are still the same way they were. So these old, for instance, the Ndrangheta, the Calabrian mafia still has a very, very strong grip on the distribution channels. Some of the old things are still there, but I guess the cultural barriers that were around for so long have seemed to have sort of broken down. It's really...
Can you be doing stories, you know, for the ABC and working on a novel at the same time, or do they have to be two separate? Do you have to take time off?
Yeah, I have to take time off. I find that the whole Four Corners process in particular is so intellectually demanding and requires much of your brain that I don't have time to, work every day on a novel.
Yeah.
So for Dead Letters, I did take 5 months off and worked pretty hard to get the first draft done.
Like shutting yourself away in an office, typing for however long, coffee.
I had a word count of 1,500 words a day.
Yep.
And I worked 4 days a week to do 6,000 words a week, and then on the Friday I would review what I'd written. I'd sit on it for the weekend, and then I'd start again next week. And so that way, within this certain period of time, I knew that I could get, you know, say 100,000 words written.
Yeah.
And once I'd done that, you know, then I could then go back and I could go back to work, and I could then work on, you know, refining it, rewriting, submitting it, doing the edit process, stuff I could
do. Have a first reader, or is it to an agent or an editor? What's that process when you start to collect some feedback?
Yeah, I do have a couple of first readers. I have some close friends who read my work. We have a sort of loose, sort of an old farts writing group, basically.
Can you tell us who's in it, or is that classified information?
Sure. No. A good friend of mine, Paul Daly, he's often one of my first readers.
Yep.
Chris Hammer is part of this group. There are a few people who are part of that sort of first reader group. And then there are some others who I tend to, depending on, you know, I have some doctor friends, so I get them to read particular sections.
Yep.
There's those things. I have other people who I, you know, get, I give it to read just for clarity and for, you know, get the technical things right. With Dead Letters, I had a retired New South Wales detective who was very, very helpful. So there are a group of first readers, and there's probably a group of second readers, right? Just to make sure that all that sort of stuff is right.
I am so interested in that writer's group you just talked about, you know, sitting down. Where do you meet? Do you meet at the pub? Do you meet at the – do you discuss murder? What, you know, what violent thing did you use in your last book? I'm so interested in that.
We have a loose lunch club, actually.
Lunch club. Heard it here first on the First Time podcast, everybody.
Meets at a Chinese restaurant most Fridays.
Yep.
That's been a long-standing luncheon appointment that if we happen to be in town all at the same time.
And do you so lots of writers groups we talk to, or when people talk about their writers groups, they will, you know, send stuff in advance, give feedback. There's always something about who's the person who is the most hard, the most critical, the days when you go home feeling a little bruised, a little wounded because someone's been a bit too honest. Is that the kind of relationship that happens in that?
No, not really. And we don't really talk about works in progress, actually, to be honest.
Yeah, okay. Interesting.
It's really once the thing's done. Okay. So there's not a lot of sort of backwards and forwards about, you know, oh, I've got this dilemma, or, you know, where do you think I should go with this, or that sort of stuff. It's more once things are done. And look, it's not really, it's not just a writing group. it's a long-standing old friendship group.
None of them really tend to be. Most of the ones that are long-standing are much more involved in all the other things you talk about,
I think. Describe it as a support group.
Excellent. I'm glad. The loose lunch support group. Now, I'm going to be frank, because it's what our listeners tell us they love, and I am actually deep in the throes of the post-festival kind of come down that happens after being at a writer's week, exhausted after being at all the parties and all the events. And it's obviously was a very special one for everyone because we've all been locked up for a year, and it was our first time out of the state. But I think it's a pretty regular occurrence for writers that they get these intense periods of kind of publicity and being outward facing, talking about their work like you're doing with me today. And then they have to have that 4 months that you talked about where you kind of squirreled away and you're writing your book. And I wonder how, obviously in your career as well, you've got that kind of intensity when you're away and doing stories. How do you manage those kinds of energy shifts? Like, have you come to be able to do that better? Is it just that we all need a loose lunch on a Friday? Will that get us through?
I think it probably helps. It should help. How do you come to do that better? I think over time you learn how to do it better, you know, to be honest. I find doing this sort of stuff for books, you know, when you first start, even now, you know, when the book first comes out, I'm not all that good at doing it, you know. But 6 weeks in, I've actually sort of got my mojo, you know, I'm pretty good at it. You know, and I think you learn as you go to do these sorts of things. But the ups and downs, look, I actually think that's one of the really nice things about writing, you know, is that for so long it's such an internalized process. And when it's all done and dusted and you're actually out there engaging with people about what you've done, that's really great, you know. It's really it's a wonderful moment
such a thrill. And particularly when you see, I think that I nearly actually kind of jumped off the stage and sat in the lap of the people in the first row because I was just so excited that they were real and not sitting in front of, you know, in their lounge room. I know some writers don't like to talk about their next work, but I'm wondering, is there any sense or hint you can give us of what might be obsessing you in terms of your next idea?
Yeah, I'm still sort of tossing up whether to stay. I've got a couple of sort of things going through my head at the moment. One of them involves taking Sid to outside of Sydney, and another one is deeply engaged in more criminal activity in Sydney, and I'm trying to decide which way to go, and I'm actually trying to see if I can marry them both up. So
sounds very cool. Do you ever, question without notice, do you ever worry about your own security?
I have at times, yes, definitely. Yep. And actually, there have been times where, you know, my security, our security, the family security has been threatened by
your journalism.
By my journalism, yeah, not by my fiction. You know, it can get pretty hairy sometimes. It is a reality that, you know, sometimes you are dealing with things that, you know, people don't want to be revealed.
Do you find, I can imagine, you know, from an outside person who's engaged in politics, doesn't have to write about it, doesn't have to kind of delve into it, my daily kind of frustration and anger and rage at times is such that it, you know, it finds its way into my work all the time. Do you see it as a relief to be writing fiction about these kinds of ideas and issues you've always been engaged in?
Yes, absolutely. It's so liberating, and I find the experience sort of cathartic. It's really, it's just, I similarly get incredibly frustrated with the process. The older I get, the more difficult I find the relationship between journalism and politics. It's great to be able to, not that I want to write about politics necessarily, but I think in the books that I've written so far, obviously politics play a large role in the sort of narrative discourse of those books. And it's been, I've found the experience incredibly liberating. You know, it's great to be able to take a story wherever you want to take it, you know, and not be sort of constrained by, whether it's real or not for a start, whether it's true or not, but actually being able to determine, well, actually, what happens if this happened, where would that go? And also ending up in some places when you're writing where you never thought you'd be, you know, that to me is, it's great.
It's part of the joy. Michael, can you tell us the best piece of writing advice or maybe story advice you've ever been given, something that was memorable to you?
Look, I think the best bit of advice I've ever been given about writing is just do it, you know. It just requires an enormous amount of sort of discipline, you know. And don't be worried about what you're writing because you can always change it. But it's really important to get those, for me anyway, it's really important to just set aside a particular amount of time to have a goal and to sit down and do it. And, you know, don't talk about it. Do it. There's a lot of people out there who talk about how, you know, they're writing a book or they'd like to write a book or, you know, one day they'll write a book or, you know. Well, there's talking and there's doing. And to me, the doing leads you to a conclusion.
Excellent advice and one that goes quite close to the bone today. Thank you, Michael, but that's very useful. To finish, can you please recommend a debut book? Any time or any place. We are, of course, the first time podcast, so we like these.
Yeah, look, this is, I was thinking about this sometime. This is really difficult, I'm sure, and everybody says the same thing because there's so many.
I know, right? It's a terrible question. I apologise.
But one I thought would be really good to talk about is My War Gone By, I Miss It So, by Anthony Lloyd, which was a book about the Bosnian conflict, sort of the Yugoslav wars, and it came out in 1999, and it is the most extraordinary bit of war reporting, but it's sort of personal memoir as well. And Anthony Lloyd himself is sort of almost unlikable character, but the book is like, to me, it came at a time where, you know, I'd covered those wars as well, and nothing like in the way that he had, and his extraordinary sort of upfront and personal engagement with what was going on and deep immersion into what was going on. And then he's also his own personal struggle with addiction, not just to drugs, but to the violence, to the excitement and the thrill. To me, it's one of the most amazing war books I've ever read. And that is my pick.
Good sell. I'm going to have a look at that, and we will put that in the show notes. That has to lead me on to say, Can we expect at some point from you, Michael Brissenden, a memoir of the however many years that you have been a journalist and writer?
I don't think so. I don't think, I think we're well served with lots of those sorts of memoirs. And, you know, look, I won't say no, but I think there's so many other things I want to write about other than myself for the next few years anyway. And I'm not sure that will ever change.
Well, excellent. We will look forward to some more thrillers from you. Michael, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you today. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks so much for your interest. Thank you.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.